when it comes to the blues, B.B. King makes the very short list of living legends. Along with his guitar, Lucille, B.B. has become one of the most important artists in the last 50 years. But before he was even big enough to pick up Lucille, several blues men and women paved the way for B.B. King's popular success. There was Big Amos Patton, Furry Lewis, Big Memphis Ma Rainey, Little Laura Dukes, and Bucca White, who was B.B.'s cousin, biggest supporter, and maybe his biggest critic.
He can't play with a slide too good. And he knew if we hang up, I'm going to use this slide on it. And he's going to have to jump and shout. Because I'm going to bat out on it with the slide, you know.
We can hear Bucca's critique of B.B. thanks to a college student and his tape recorder. In the early 1970s, Fred Hay, along with a friend, tracked down Bucca White and several other Memphis blues musicians and coaxed them to tell their stories and sing their songs on tape. 30 years later, Hay gathered the transcripts into a book called Going Back to Sweet Memphis, Conversations with the Blues. Hay recalls Bucca White liked to meet people at his office.
That was a little bench he'd stuck on the sidewalk down the hill from his apartment. So we met him in his office, and he took us up to his apartment, to his living room, where we conducted the interview.
What was it like just to be with him?
Bucca had been recording since the 30s and some amazingly beautiful stuff he did, and very influential. So we were somewhat intimidated in Bucca's presence, but he did all he could to put us at ease. He was such a great raconteur. You couldn't believe half of what he said, but whatever he said was always fascinating. Very soon, we were very relaxed in his company.
Now, that's Bucca White from a recording that you made, Fred. Bucca White was B.B. King's cousin, and actually, Bucca gave B.B. his first guitar. Let's listen to Bucca White tell that story.
B.B. was about 6 or 7 years old. I gave him a brand new Stella. And he was sitting on the floor. He just was quiet, you know. And I was on his quid, my ain't a half. And so he looked so pitiful. I had a Stella. I used to play nothing but a Stella guitar.
Yeah.
And when I got ready to go that morning, I'm going to Moorhead. And me and George, we were together then, and B.B. looked so pitiful. George said, "What you getting that guitar? I'll buy you nothing in Moorhead. They got plenty of them there." So I just turned around and pulled it from over my head, the string I had over my head, and gave it to him. And so that gave him a good feeling to start. He's been going ever since.
Bucca is talking about coming to Moorhead to see his cousin, B.B. King's mother. And he and George Bullitt Williams, the great harp blower, were together. And he had a Stella guitar that he had on a strap over his back. B.B. was about 6 years old and very much taken with the guitar. And George said, "Why don't you give it to him, Bucca? You can get another one in Moorhead." And so Bucca took it off and gave it to him, and that made B.B.'s day.
How did Bucca White feel about B.B.'s success?
Well, I think he was glad of his success, as were all the other musicians that knew him that we interviewed. They were somewhat taken back, though, that B.B. in his frequent interviews failed to mention the role they had played. He rarely mentioned Bucca. He didn't mention, until more recently, the role Robert Jr. Lockwood and Joe Willie Wilkins, who spent many hours working with B.B., teaching him how to play. And in the interview with Joe Willie and Houston Stackhouse, Houston tries to bring that up, and Joe Willie just tells him to kind of cool out. We don't want to talk about that sort of thing. But on the other hand, Memphis Ma Rainey tells a story that she was the one that kept B.B. going. When early in his career, he was disheartened, he wasn't making any money, that they would meet at a place down on Bill Street called Hamburger Heaven about 3 o'clock every morning after they had performed all night. And he was going to quit, but she encouraged him to keep going, and that's why he continued and made the great star that he is today.
Bobby was just sweet 16. You just left your home then, baby.
Fred, you're not from Memphis yourself, so how'd you find yourself there in the early 70s?
I was a college student. I went to Memphis when I was 17 to matriculate at Southwestern at Memphis College, now known as Rhodes College. And I had the privilege of being in Professor John Quincy Wolfe's folklore class. And part of the requirement of that course was to go out and interview an old-time musician, a traditional musician of some sort. And I interviewed a Memphis musician, a blues musician by the name of Willie Highway 61 Blackwell. And that was my first experience interviewing any of the Memphis musicians. It was a remarkable experience in that some of these people, fairly famous, some very obscure, but all of them agreed to talk to us, to allow these two young white guys, Bill Lyons and myself, to come to their homes and interview them and to perform for us on tape.
But not everyone trusted you, I understand.
I know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, well, we don't.
I know about it. You can take what I play or what I speak and take it to a recording company and get my name and put it on the head and shit, man, get a millionaire.
That's Tommy Gehry. He was an outstanding harmonica player and a very influential one, but relatively obscure today.
What is it that he's afraid that you'll do?
That we'll record him, that we'll make a record and sell the record, that we'll make money for ourselves and not for him. Not without some justification, I might add. Furry Lewis wouldn't play his guitar when the tape recorder was on because that very thing had happened to him. People had come to his house, he had played for them, they had released a record, they made money, he got no royalties.
What was it like looking him up?
Well, Furry was always great, and he was always telling stories and joking. So as soon as you'd ask Furry a question, like, well, Furry, where were you born, and when were you born? He'd start off, well, I was born in Mississippi, but I wasn't raised there. They started to raise me there, but the rope broke. And he'd laugh at himself and then say that he came to Memphis when he was six. Well, who brought you to Memphis? Well, my mother and my stepdaddy. I never did see my daddy. I never knew my daddy, just my stepdaddy, and he was real mean. He'd give all the kids a nickel on Christmas Eve, steal it when we were asleep, and then beat us on Christmas Day because we lost our nickels.
So were any of these things true?
Well, he didn't know his father. I don't know how mean his stepfather was. They were very poor when he was a child in Memphis, and then he lost his leg as a teenager when he fell off a freight train he was hopping. So he had a wooden leg all his life. He couldn't make enough money off his music to support himself, so he was a street sweeper in Memphis for many decades. But none of that hurt Furry's spirit.
Fred, throughout your book, there are many pictures, they're almost really etchings, of the musicians that you spoke with. And some of these etchings are very beautiful. They're haunting. They're almost kind of gothic. One of the etchings is called Ukulady, and it features Little Laura Dukes. And she doesn't seem like a typical Memphis blues musician.
Well, Little Laura's father was Alec Duke. He was a drummer in W.C. Handy's orchestra. And she had been performing publicly in Memphis since she was five. But she was about 4'7" and 85 pounds and as cute as she could be. But she initially learned to play the ukulele from the Delta Blues great Robert Nighthawk, a very traditional Delta-type musician. She was atypical of the Memphis blues as it was in the 70s, but very popular.
With the dog?
That's her poodle.
Her what?
Her poodle. She had a little miniature poodle her boyfriend had given her, and that dog started barking right on cue when she sang that the bulldog started barking in the song Stack of Lee. The poodle starts barking, and in the song she yells at him to shut up.
What was the poodle's name?
I don't know. I never heard it called by name. She'd refer to it as the poodle.
Fred, when you were talking to these musicians as a college student, do you ever feel like you were doing something really important while you were recording them?
I had no idea. The thought did not occur to me to do anything with them other than, you know, to make them and to get a grade in the class. It was only years later when someone asked me a question, and I knew that we had discussed that on one of the tapes, and I dug them out and started listening to them. I said, you know, this is some important stuff.
Little Laura Dukes, her ukulele, and her poodle. You can find her stories and those of other Memphis blues legends in Going Back to Sweet Memphis, Conversations with the Blues, edited by Fred Hay. Here is one of the musicians featured in the book, Furry Lewis, singing Cassie Jones in 1928. I'm Corva Coleman. Good evening from All Things Considered and NPR News.
Cassie looked at his water. Water was low. Looked at his watch. Watch was slow. On the road again. And that phone is on the road again. Lord, the people tell by the sort of moan. The man to find Mr. Cassie Jones, Mr. Cassie Jones. Mr. Cassie said before he died, one more road and he wants to ride. People tell kids which road is he. The Southern Pacific and the Sanctuary, Sanctuary.